Welcome to the DK UK podcast. My name is Daniel Kelly. DK UK is a hairdressing salon based in Peckham since 2014. Here in the salon, customers look at art instead of a mirror while they get their hair cut. This began as an art project and has grown into a successful business. The salon came about as a reaction to living in London, which is now a very expensive and overcrowded city, not leaving much space for artists to show their work outside of the commercial art world. I trained as a hairdresser before I went to art college, and after several years of trudging through the art world trying to make a living, I decided to combine the two areas of my life, art and hairdressing, and hey presto, haircuts in front of art. On the DK UK podcast, I will be chatting to a range of guests whilst giving them a haircut on the themes present in DK UK, such as how artists earn a living, public funding in the arts, and what sort of length do you want the fringe? I recommend listening to the podcast through headphones and hope you enjoy the chat. Any likes, shares, ratings, etc. would be greatly appreciated. And what was that? Here comes our client. Okay, better go. Okay, Theo. So what are we going to do with your haircut today?
Well, it's very long, Daniel.
Yeah.
Because I've been waiting for this podcast for 6 months.
Yeah.
But we're gonna keep the bob that you did.
Yeah.
Before, we're just gonna shorten it, just so I can see.
So we do the length at the front, sort of
exactly.
Onto the eyebrow.
Yeah, yeah.
Drop that down.
Yeah.
And how short do you want to go at the back?
I don't want any kind of like undercut.
Okay.
Particularly, so well, or you know, like, so we'll kind of
read my mind. I was just thinking, maybe a bit of an undercut, kind of.
Well, I mean, we could do it with scissors, but definitely not a,
shaved.
Yeah. We could do a bit of a scissor undercut, but not too much. I don't want too much.
So you can do whatever you want. Are you thinking you don't want an undercut because you want it to feel quite sort of full?
Like yeah, I quite like a bit of weight. Yeah,
well, let's not do the undercut.
Yeah,
that's fine. Yeah. Can cut it. So it's short on the hairline, and then the weight just sits.
Yeah, exactly. That's
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's it.
You're not making it easy for me. It's a very hard hair.
Is it? Well,
I'm gonna have to.
You won't be able to talk.
Try and.
I'll have to think of some amusing stories.
Yeah, as well. But that's cool. I'm professional.
Yeah. It is, for all the listeners.
Yeah.
8:30 in the morning. So Daniel's got his work cut out.
And we had some audio issues.
We've had audio issues.
We've got a new recorder. It's all good. And we're finally getting to do your hair. Thank goodness. So we installed your show in March.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we did.
Beginning.
Yeah, beginning of March. The longest show you've ever had.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And it's now August.
The longest show I've ever had.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even like, you know, even the few like institutional bits are only 3 months.
Yeah, you put it on the DK UK solo.
Yeah, exactly. DK 6 months solo. It was so popular, we ran it twice. Yeah.
And what do they call it in the West End? Yeah. Show extended.
Yeah, exactly. Show extended.
Yeah,
new cast. You look younger, Daniel, but the rest of us.
What happened? We installed it. We had 2 weeks.
Yes.
We spent a year planning it.
And I mean, and longer, really.
No,
yes, it was. No, I mean, I had the first...
You came to a visit.
The first studio visit I had was with Cairo.
Oh, God.
So, I mean, that's like 18 months at least, right? Oh. I was in that funding round, the Arts Council round, that was like, you know, when you were still in the...
Reapply?
Yeah. So this show has been in gestation for the best part of 2 years, I reckon.
You came here very early, and that was November 2018.
Absolutely.
So the studio visit must have been...
Yeah, I mean, the year... Yeah, exactly.
It's now 2020, so yeah, basically 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a 2018 studio visit before that, you know, before you'd moved here, before it was even kind of when you were like looking here. So it's been a long time. And then it was up for 2 weeks and then it was closed. So,
So Cairo was helping me with the exhibition.
Yes.
She worked as a curator for a while, and she picked your work out.
Yeah.
I think the part of the reason we loved it was because of the, you know, the sort of environments that you're making.
Yeah.
And we thought it'd be really interesting to almost collaborate with DK UK's context.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we've got such a strong context that we thought it'd be really interesting to see what you came up with those parameters. Lots of personal stuff going on for you as well, which sort of meant...
Well, of course, yeah. I had a baby, so we pushed the
pushed it to the end of the run. And here we are. So maybe you could you talk us through what we've...
Yeah, the show.
With what we're looking at now or what we put in the space originally?
I reckon let's talk about the show as it... Maybe the show as it was... Well, let's talk about it conceptually, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, so the show has changed because of the requirements that you now have, the government requirements for the post-coronavirus salon. But the show itself, it's called A Love Affair at a Distance. And it's, so I kind of, what I was interested in, I mean, in both, I suppose in general in my work, but also very much to try to do with you, was to kind of think about how the salon is used and how, I suppose, how you kind of create... Well, I suppose to broaden it out a bit, I'm interested in using kind of galleries or exhibition spaces in general as a kind of storied space where kind of like...
As a kind of storied space. Storied space, yeah.
So like a kind of narrative space. So I've kind of spent quite a lot of years thinking about how you kind of impose bits of narrative in the gallery, or in the exhibition space, more broadly. So I've done a lot of things in relation to that, you know, with using kind of film conventions and placing them in the exhibition, and also bits of theatrical convention and stuff like that. Always really built around installations. And what really interested me in with the DK UK context is I kind of had come up with this idea that in galleries you have this exhibition time, which is like, you know, if film has a sort of temporality, like a certain kind of type of time, which is to do with editing, then exhibitions have a kind of time which is to do with how you move around space, right? Or how an artist creates the authors the exhibition, basically, or a curator or authors the exhibition to control the flow.
That's a very nice explanation. That's probably the clearest explanation I've heard of that. That's really nice, yeah.
I'm trying to be, you know... but yeah, so that's
and so films have a time.
Yeah, exactly.
They're very material.
Completely, you know, and you know, I mean, what's always really interesting. I studied film initially at university, but I transferred to fine art, and what was funny. So I was at London College of Printing studying film.
Yeah,
and I did a foundation before, and then I went there, and I was really interested in certain kind of elements of film. I mean, probably really the elements I'm still sort of interested in, which is like kind of affect and, you know, kind of romance and these kinds of, the kind of ability to transport you somewhere.
Yeah.
But I just realized, like, they have an amazing setup that they did at London College of Printing, I'm sure they still do, where they had like a TV studio and all this kind of equipment and everything. But I just really realized that, like, I was really not interested in going into that as an industry. You know, like, I wasn't really interested in making that kind of thing at all. I just really wanted to be in a studio. And I spent the whole year, the first year of my BA, being there, like, why am I not in a studio? This is, you know, feeling really out of place. But the one thing I really found really interesting is we did film...
How long did you do the film course for then?
So I did 1 year,
the whole year
of the BA, the first year. And then I transferred to Camberwell after that. But, you know, you study theory alongside the practical. And one of the things that I found really interesting is the, like, really, really interesting stayed with me is that the idea, like, you would learn, they would teach you, like, with diagrams and things, like, how to read films, you know? Like, in terms of how, I suppose, how like a scene is set, and also how different types of edits, like cuts, mean different things, or are read in different ways, right? So like, you know, a fade suggests, like a fade will suggest time passing, and like a jump cut will be like a kind of, you know, a sudden kind of juxtaposition, but very temporally very quick, you know, and all this kind of stuff that, you know, you'd, I don't know, I was whatever, like 20 or something, and you know, you'd watch films for 20 years, right, but you'd never realize that there was this whole like language underneath the thing that you were watching. So I think that kind of stuck with me, and then I
my education in film came from that Mark Cousins documentary.
The
Story of Film.
I remember. Yeah, really good.
So yeah, it's like a whole vernacular, basically.
Totally, right.
And I guess it's, do you think it's the same as classical music? So it's,
absolutely,
it's like,
yeah,
a sort of, it's a language that we've learned through osmosis.
Completely. And we stop to, you know, and part of the point of it is that we don't, you know, those who experience it are supposed to be, you know, like that suspension of disbelief or whatever, that moment of like transporting is really important. So, you know, you're not really supposed to sit there and go, oh, there's a fade to black, it's important that you don't notice that stuff.
Like the way people look to the left and the right as they're having a conversation.
Yeah, so, completely. Yeah. And I think it's probably the same, you know, across a lot of, you know, it's definitely the same across a lot of like artistic forms. You know, architecture has languages and they mean things. You know, lots of artists have worked on it and you know, on the kind of the language of power that's present in architecture, you know, and that's all very interesting. But it's quite similar, you know. You'll build a, you know, the what's always amazing about, you know, postmodernism or whatever, you know, if you go into the Paternoster Square or whatever, like Pablo Bronstein made a lot of works about that. Is, you know, this vernacular of classical architecture that was built as facades in the city to make these buildings, these kind of modern temples, you know, there's temples of finance, right? And the fact that they chose to use porticos and marble and you know, and arches and, you know, all this type of thing, recycled language to be imposing and powerful, to talk about wealth and power, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's an aside, but back to the film thing, the film time, exhibition time, I kind of started to think a lot about how a similar kind of set of codes exist within exhibitions. And that's kind of been something that's run through the work for quite a long time, really. And
when you say exhibitions, are you talking sort of the history of like museums, or are you talking more in contemporary art?
I mean, immediately focused in contemporary art. I think I was very influenced by, when we were both at art school, obviously you had that kind of relational aesthetics crowd, right? And I guess I never really made that kind of work, but elements of that, less the the obvious examples of it were always eating, weren't they? Like everyone was like, we'll eat in the exhibition or whatever.
Yeah.
I remember
I heard of relational aesthetics.
Yeah, exactly.
That basically is.
Yeah.
The artist would set up a dinner.
Yeah, so
a cooking kitchen in a gallery.
Completely.
And people would come and.
And it was kind of talked about by Nicholas Bourrier, who wrote it, as this kind of, you know, as like a kind of new utopian model of engagement with art. But the bits that I guess there were some artists, you know, Pierre Huyghe and Philip Perrino and those kind of guys who were really, really into film. And actually they did a lot of work, I suppose, with, they kind of interested me in these kind of ways, thinking about like time and the kind of the exhibition. In some manners, you know, I mean, I don't know, like a famous thing by Perrino might be like, you know, he did this work about Zidane, right? You know, and he filmed Zinedine Zidane during, he got all the camera footage of Zinedine Zidane during a football match.
Yeah.
And he made this multi-screen installation, which is just him for 90 minutes from every camera angle, but only him.
Oh, is that what
him.
He made that film?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's an amazing work to see, you know, if you see it in the exhibition space, because it's just like so intense, right?
I didn't realize that came. I've seen the film.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it came.
Well, initially, no. I think he did. I don't know which way around it was. I don't know whether he initially made it as a single screen.
Yeah.
And then he expanded it into like a multi-screen, or vice versa. But I saw it at Palais de Tokyo as a multi-screen. When he did a carte blanche, like whole show there. Anyway, so I guess, you know, those kind of things were all kind of informing that kind of that context, right?
So when I suppose you landed at Camberwell and you start your sort of fine art.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, I suppose to kind of come back to your question about like. I guess that was the kind of like the initial, which was at the time very temporary, right? Like it was very much contemporary art happening then.
Yeah.
And I guess it's expanded a bit since, you know, broadened out into the kind of broader context of exhibition making. And anyway, so to kind of come full circle back round to DKUK, one of the initial thing, you know, when I first, you know, Cairo contacted me, and then, you know, through the first conversations, as I thought, it's super interesting, because I've been thinking a lot about this kind of like exhibition time, right, what it was. And then I thought, obviously, the uniqueness of DKUK is it has two temporalities, because a salon must also have a temporality, like a time, like a sort of, a temporality, right? And, you know, it's to do with clients coming in and the different lengths of time that people are here and the way that it's moved around, you know. So that kind of informed quite a lot of how I began to think about the show, and I liked the idea of, you know, having these moments where someone could be waiting, and that was like a possible space, you know, that was a possible bit of time.
Because it timed in with us moving into our bigger space as well, where our old space was like a cupboard, and so suddenly we had space where
completely.
People would be waiting, moving.
Yeah.
And you came along.
And I came to the LARP that you did.
The live action role play where we were with the architects to sort of figure out
how people would use the space.
The flow.
So that was quite interesting for me because, you know, it was very much about like, okay, like we got this space and how do people move around it? Because it's an interesting thing. I mean, you know, in a gallery it's quite simple actually. You know, you've got, I mean, obviously galleries vary, you know, immensely, and discourses vary from, you know, institution to kind of project space, but you know, you don't have very much else going on in the gallery, right? The thing that
the artist's got control, right?
Yeah, the artist has total control. So I mean, there's other things going on, but basically you can say, okay, I want, you know, I need to build a wall, or like, around. Let's say, like, I don't want the invigilator to sit here, you know, like, I don't want the front desk to be, you know, like, whatever, you know, like, you
or
can move.
Full size motorway bridge to watch videos
on. Exactly, you know, right? That's what I feel like, right? and obviously, this is a kind of very different situation in that respect, but quite an interesting one for me, because. Because I suppose the other thing that I'd started to do in other shows around that time was write these kind of stories that were designed, I suppose, to kind of animate the exhibition. So I kind of set up these situations where you had what like these kind of artworks in a way, which in a kind of traditional sort of sense,
way,
I guess.
Yeah.
So kind of works on walls and you know, pseudo sculptural works and, you know, things that feel like, you know, physical artworks, right? And I was interested in like how perhaps you could like animate their existence through stories and through music. So kind of imposing bits of this kind of the filming stuff. So like, you could kind of create music that was like, you know, if you listen to music while you look at a piece of art, right, it changes very much what the art means, right? You know, for example, because suddenly you have this whole emotional score, right? Which, you know, it's very different to sitting in a, you know, to kind of being in a, either a kind of hushed institution or or a kind of like noisy opening in a project space. So I was interested in how like those things could sort of be kind of incorporated in into the show, and into this show particularly, because what I realized is that obviously simultaneously you'd have people kind of arrive, like, because some people stay for like a longer time.
Yeah, so we have people who come in for colors.
Yeah.
They can be here all afternoon. Really,
exactly,
three,
right.
4 hours.
And then, you know, your normal haircuts, what, like, you know, it's an hour slot, you know, maybe they're here 45 minutes or whatever. So you have these kind of different lengths of time. And I realized that, you know, you kind of fundamentally have these people who populate the exhibition, like kind of characters in a way, right? They're like sort of actors in this kind of film or theater that is being orchestrated by me by making works that sit here. So I decided to kind of really play on that, and the show itself is in the kind of large space in the downstairs, the hair cutting space. There were six fabric wall hangings that I made that are sort of, you know, one on the one hand kind of like big paintings really, and on the other hand are kind of a bit like a theatrical backdrop. And they sit, the six, you know, because of the potential of having the chairs that, so that you kind of can have one each. And
so they're raw hanging canvas.
Yeah,
they?
They're just raw canvas that with kind of
that fitted in with our flat wall system.
Exactly.
Well. So you used our sort of.
So they're hung from the flat wall system. Completely. So they got eyelets and they're kind of they're very minimal really work. They're big colour washes.
Is it paint then? Is it paint on my hand?
Yeah. They're big colour washes with. A lot of masking out going on, and so there's a kind of triptych, which is basically like a large window. It's kind of designed to be like a kind of large modernist kind of window, and then there's a kind of three panel on the other wall, which is now two panels. But and originally the show had, if anyone saw it in the first 2 weeks, it had a seat in the middle, which was kind of designed that so you could kind of, if you were waiting or like whatever, you could kind of sit on the seat and you're in the middle, so like maybe someone's you know, waiting with a color, and there you kind of see them in front of sort of this backdrop. And and I also wrote a story that's part of the show, and the story is about happens on one night in the opera, and is a sort of is about the end of a love affair that happens in the opera, and it's a sort of slightly dramatic fall of a relationship.
We've all got to know it very well now.
Yeah.
For the reasons we're telling you shortly.
Yeah. So I mean, originally it was. So I made this chair, and it was a. It was a love seat. So love seats were. Popular in the 19th century. 18th and 19th century, actually, particularly the 19th century. And they kind of have, if you imagine, they sort of are like two chairs side by side, one facing either way, and they allowed for polite courtship. You know, amongst society. And yes, so you could kind of, you know, chat politely and without having to sort of face each other or anything embarrassing like this. So I made a love seat, but I made there's an amazing book that it's modernist designer architect Enzo Mari made, which is of designs of furniture using standard woods, the kind of standard wood that you buy from a wood yard. So he kind of he did all these designs so that, you know, at home you could make yourself some modernist furniture.
Yeah. So to interrupt for 1 minute, I had a client in after lockdown, and her son had been making furniture out of the book.
Oh, really?
During lockdown.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I don't know. I don't really know how. I don't know how popular it is. I mean, I know it's a bit of a thing amongst a certain kind of, you know, a certain sort of group of people. The architects like it a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite kind of commonly known amongst that. But I don't know how widely known it is, you know, beyond that.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it.
No, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I'd heard of it by talking to some architects who told me about it.
Yeah.
Although I did see, which was kind of, I mean, the Dan Vo exhibition at South Under Gallery that happened last year, he made a Enzamari furniture from sort of in that style, in that. So
I like what you did by putting it in the middle there, because that was actually quite similar to the original sort of DK UK and the thinking behind that, because in that it was a very long thin room.
Yeah.
So the idea was that people were walking past and they were looking through the window.
Exactly.
And they're seeing the hairdressers in front of the art.
Yeah, like working in this kind of vitrine space, right?
Ship, yeah.
So and it talked about the performative nature of your practice a bit.
Our working bench isn't in the middle, so by you putting the bench in the middle, you'd sort of...
Yeah, reinserted that a little bit.
Put us in between the sort of work, or really more in it, I suppose.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I guess at the time, you know, pre-coronavirus, as well, you could come and see the show as, you know, without an appointment, right? Like you didn't need to, you could pop in and have a look as well. So that was, I suppose, another element in one of the nice things about when you were at Holdren's is that, you know, you could go and see the show and you would just kind of, you know, wander by, right? And you'd be in there cutting hair and you could kind of have a little look at what someone had done.
Yeah.
And obviously, well, now you kind of can't come in, you know, without appointment. You know, at the time you could pop in and have a look, right? So it was also, I was kind of imagining, you know, that people could also come and sit on that chair in the way that people used to see Holdren's, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But anyway, so the chair was very nice, but could not stay because there was not enough space when the requirements, the distancing requirements came.
And we couldn't we can't have things that multiple people touch. So
exactly, and all these kinds of things.
Magazines
Exactly, all this kind of business. So
you can't even have people waiting, you know, have space out of the appointment.
Exactly. So it kind of broke the logic of the kind of waiting, watching visitor / you know, whatever. But so we changed it to being so we kept, obviously the audio remained because it was a very important part of the work. But then we decided to play the audio through the in-house PA, kind of periodically.
Whoever's on reception now, they're sort of drilled to
in charge.
Wait for the song to finish.
Yeah, exactly.
Fade that out and then fade in yours. It has to wait for the song to finish, then you come in.
Yeah, exactly.
With your
very
sort
important
of silky tones.
Yeah.
Sort of fades in.
Yeah, so now it's played periodically, which you say is very successful, so that's nice. And obviously it creates a different dynamic, but quite a nice one still, because it stops, I mean, you know, the kind of headphone situation is quite a personal thing, I guess, you know, when you listen to a work through headphones, you're in your own sort of space, right? More like an audiobook sort of scenario.
Mm. Yeah.
But I imagine that the kind of, there's more of a performative element suddenly with it played out loud, because suddenly, you know, I sort of imagine that, if, you know, as a client here, suddenly you have this story that's delivered to you about this sort of love affair at the opera.
At a distance,
exactly. So that's kind of how the show has ended up.
And we've got your book still as well.
Oh, yeah, and there's a...
No one can touch them, so, yeah.
Yeah, that was also, you know, an element of... Because I was writing a book at the time. I published a book, like an artist book, just also, basically it was ready at the point that the lockdown happened also. And I liked initially the idea of, you know, people, if anyone was waiting, in the way that you might look at a magazine in you know, here. Like, you could also just flick through this book. And the book is a series of short stories written by me and a group of invited writers, sort of artists and writers, who I asked to contribute. And the book is all set during one night. Like, that's the idea. It's like set during one night in a metropolitan city. But it's a very kind of well, the stories are kind of dispersed around, and everything's kind of slightly non-specific geographically. So it's a kind of series of vignettes, really, except with one sort of five-part story that kind of runs through, like a kind of meta narrative. And the story that's in the that's recorded for the show here is part of that book. And I guess the book as a project was also about the kind of the same logics of my work, the practice in general, which was kind of thinking about how you can kind of expand this kind of storied kind of context of the exhibition, and this kind of storied, to kind of make a storied practice.
Do you find writing quite easy?
Well, you know what? Like, I didn't used to at all. It's never was in my natural form, but I think I used to use, like, for a lot of years, for quite a few years when earlier on when I was making work, I used to take a lot of stuff. You know, like, I used to kind of use bits of pre-existing text and bits of films and bits of stuff, you know, like, that I would kind of use verbatim.
Yeah.
Or edit a bit. But I don't know, there was just a moment where it kind of just clicked. I felt like I needed to write a bit more. I've been doing some stuff with fan fiction. Basically, I've been doing some stuff with fan fiction. And I guess I'd thought a lot. I'd had a few conversations with people, and I'd been thinking about how much I enjoyed Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet when I was a teenager, right, when I was a kid, right? I remember going to see it in the cinema.
It's aged very well.
Yeah, right?
Visually, it's aged.
Totally. But, I mean, and I just remember, like, I mean, I was maybe, like, you know, I don't know, I can't remember, maybe I was 13 or something. And it was, like, totally blew my mind, like, the music and all this, like, massive, like, big aesthetic and all the romance, you know.
Let's not forget a young Leo.
And a young Leo, exactly, you know, all of it was there, all the parts were there. And anyway, so I thought about it a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, I thought about it again. I was doing a residency in Switzerland with a filmmaker called Louis Henderson, who contributed to the book. And we'd kind of ended up having a really long conversation about it, about how good we both had thought it was. And then I was thinking, oh, it's interesting, like, how you transpose text. And obviously, you know, Romeo and Juliet is a text which is one of the world's most famous plays, right? And kind of stories in a sense. And that has interestingly been adapted into an opera. And if you read the opera, I've looked at the, you know, looked into the opera, and it's really interesting because in the opera they obviously have to massively shorten, like, massively cut any like the text and most of the kind of, I guess, some of the complexities, literary kind of complexities of the story.
Yeah.
Because the opera is all about big emotional moments, right?
Yeah.
So they're kind of authoring. So they authored it for these huge moments, right? And they cut a lot of other bits.
Yeah.
So I was kind of interested in that, and then I realized that I'd been thinking quite a bit about fan fiction and how kind of, I guess, what happens when people are allowed to add to pre-existing texts. And I realized that, mainly because it's on the curriculum, I think, both in the UK and in America, you've got a lot of, like, teen fiction.
Based on it.
Yeah, based on Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
Which is quite fascinating. And also, I think Taylor Swift wrote a song that I found out. Or maybe Taylor Swift, maybe someone else, wrote a song that's based on Romeo and Juliet. So a lot of it's based on the lyrics of that song, actually. So I made this work that really comprised of alternative, kind of edited alternative endings to Romeo and Juliet, which basically largely just was them not dying. That's just pretty much, was mainly them not dying.
It
was basically the theme of them. And but so in the book, you know, I was also interested in like how that, like writing and things. So from kind of making those works, I then thought, no, like, I, you know, really for any of this to logically work, you know, I need to be doing this writing. Like, you know, I need to be like the fan, right? You know, I can't be taking the fan's work and using it, right? Like, I mean, it's interesting. I think it's a really, really interesting thing to be empowered by, potentially to be empowered by some other, you know, textual work. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, finding voice through it. Like, and I guess that was my interest in it, in the way that, like, when you're, you know, people find voice through, you know, music or you know, often, you know, maybe, like, it's a kind of, or film and stuff, you know, particularly when they're young, right?
Could you just explain quickly what fan fiction is?
So fan fiction is, it's kind of, originally it was, it's kind of, and I guess when people imagine it, you know, they think a lot of like Star Trek and Star Wars and those kinds of things. And I suppose the initial fan groups were quite largely based in America, and they wrote like kind of zines, basically. You know, they would write, they'd meet up at conventions, and they would, you know, have written bits of, you know, backstory to Star Trek or to, you know, whatever these universes that they were really into.
Yeah.
And also, interestingly, they often allowed for like explorations of other kind of identities, which were maybe at the time not so visible. Like, there's a lot of queer writing, like around like Star Trek and things like that. So, so it was also like a voice, like an area for certain, you know, groups of people who maybe found voice through it. So I was quite interested in this. And you know, today it's obviously with the internet, it kind of became enormous, because when you had to kind of find a group of people in your local area, or you know, once a year move, you know, to a convention, it was obviously more difficult. But now, you know, you have huge numbers of forums where you can, you know, write about, you know, whatever your favorite TV program is. And big franchises have got quite into it. So, I mean, you know, Harry Potter fan fiction is like an enormous thing, you know.
Yeah.
J.K. Rowling, you know, launched this like website, which is basically kind of modeled on that, you know. And now when like, you know, also like, for example, with the relaunching of the Star Wars universe by Disney, they started to utilize, as I understand, a lot of, they sort of sent people into the forums, you know, like to kind of see what fans were interested in, you know.
They wanted to extend it.
Exactly.
As they could, right?
So it became quite powerful as well, like within the industry. And I was interested in, anyway, so to come back, I was interested in sort of how a bit of that kind of form of world making could exist in my work. And the book, which was called Into the Night, is, I suppose, an attempt at that. So with me and a group of other invited people authoring a kind of world, or like a moment that happens in a single night, in this specific place.
We'll put a link to the book as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Left.
Yeah, absolutely.
Online. Yeah, you can buy it online.
Yeah.
I'm just
going to
blast your head.
Yeah, do it.
Coming to the end now, just a few little tweaks.
Yeah, so, I mean, I know, so I guess, so within that world building, like, I guess this show is kind of a part of that world, right? And
we're a part of that world.
Exactly, right? We're a part. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You are literally a key protagonist at the moment, the main protagonist, maybe.
Oh, special.
Yeah. and you know, the idea is that like other things, you know, there's some other kind of things that can come from that book. You know, performances and bits and pieces. Yeah, that come out of that text. All those texts.
Have you got anything else in the pipeline?
Well, obviously everything's a bit crazy, really. Yeah. I mean, I'm supposed to be doing a performance, of, you know, for in Marseille for Manifesta. But you know, will I go to France? I don't know.
When is that?
That would be right at the beginning of October. Okay, so that would be also. That work is written to be, you know, another expansion from the book. So, you know, another kind of one of these world building.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah. So it's quite a lot of things are a little bit like that at the moment, really. It's a bit unknown what will happen or in what form or what's really going on. So.
Yeah, all we can do is control what we can, isn't it?
Exactly, writing.
Adapt.
You know,
yeah, right.
Write another book.
Make some more videos.
Make a video. Get back to the video work. Yeah.
Okay.
Daniel, it's beautiful.
Oh, good.
I love it.
I've done it a bit softer than last time when I cut your hair.
It was a bit harder, yeah.
I've seen how you wear it, you know, you're pretty low maintenance.
Yeah.
Just let it do its thing. So it's still got this sort of weight to it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of softer sort of.
Oh, lovely.
Edge.
Nice back. Oh.
Tidied up there.
Beautiful. A little.
Nice.
Oh, I love it.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
I'm relieved 6 months later to finally have had a haircut.
Well, I never. Very interesting. Thanks for listening to the DK UK podcast. I hope you enjoyed that. I would also like to thank Arts Council England for their continued support of DK UK, Open School East for helping me get the recordings off the ground, and Joey Four for this great music you can hear underneath. For more information about DK UK, you can check out the website, which is www.dkuk.biz. And as I said, any likes, shares, ratings on the iTunes Store, friends to tell about through social media would be greatly appreciated. And if you're in Peckham, come and get a haircut and have your own chat. Thanks a lot. Bye.